This is a True Crime Today Dark Side Flashback.
Robert Allen Durst is an American real estate heir and suspected serial killer. The son of New York businessman Seymour Durst and the elder brother of Douglas Durst, head of the Durst Organization, he's suspected of having murdered three people. Kathleen McCormick Durst, his first wife, who disappeared in New York in 1982, Susan Bierman, his longtime friend, who was killed in California in 2000, and his neighbor Morris Black, who was killed in Texas in 2001. Durst was the subject of a multi-state manhunt after Black's body parts were found floating in Galveston Bay. Although he admitted to the dismembering of Black, which he was not charged with, he was ultimately acquitted of his murder on the grounds of self-defense. On March 14, 2015, Durst was arrested in New Orleans on first-degree murder warrants in relation to the Berman killing. On November 4, 2016, he was transferred to California and soon after was arraigned in Los Angeles on first-degree murder charges. On October 2018, Los Angeles County Superior Judge Mark Windham ruled there was sufficient evidence for Durst to be tried for the death of Berman. His trial began on March 2, 2020, but was postponed when Judge Windham announced that the trial, which had been underway for 6 days, will stand adjourned until a later date due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After additional COVID-19-related delays and a denied defense motion for a mistrial, the trial is currently scheduled to resume in April of 2021. The eldest of four children, Robert Durst, was born on April 12, 1943, and grew up in Scarsdale, New York, in a Jewish family. He's the son of real estate investor Seymour Durst and his wife Bernice Herstein. His siblings are Douglas, Tommy, and Wendy. Durst's parental grandfather, Joseph Durst, who was a tailor when he immigrated from Austria-Hungary in 1902, eventually became a successful real estate manager and developer, founding the Durst Organization in 1927. Seymour became head of the family business in 1974 upon his father's death. When Robert was seven, his mother died as a result of a fall from the family's Scarsdale home. He later claimed that moments before her death, his father walked him to a window from which he could see her standing on the roof. On a March 2015 New York Times interview, however, his brother Douglas denied that Robert had witnessed her death. As children, Robert and Douglas underwent counseling for sibling rivalry. In 1953, a psychiatrist report on 10-year-old Robert mentioned personality decomposition and possibly even schizophrenia. Durst attended Scarsdale High School, where classmates described him as a loner. He earned a bachelor's degree in economics in 1965 from Lee University, where he was a member of the varsity lacrosse team and the business manager of the Brown and White student newspaper. Durst enrolled in a doctoral program at the University of California, Los Angeles. Later that year, where he met Susan Berman, but eventually withdrew from the school and returned to New York in 1969. Durst went on to become a real estate developer in the Durst Organization. However, his brother Douglas was appointed in 1992 to run the family business. The appointment caused a rift between Robert and his family, which eventually led to him suing for his share of the family fortune. Police have directly questioned Durst and sometimes conducted searches in connection to disappearances of his first wife, Catherine McCormick, the homicides of Berman and Morris Black. He was tried and acquitted of the murder in the Black case. In the fall of 1971, Durst met Kathy McCormick, a medical student. After two dates, he invited McCormick to share his home in Vermont, where he had opened a health food store. She moved there in January 1972. However, Durst's father pressured him to move back to New York to work in the family business. The couple returned to Manhattan, where they married on April 12, 1973, Durst's 30th birthday. Shortly before her disappearance, McCormick was a student in her fourth and final year at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx and was only a few months short of earning her degree. She intended to become a pediatrician. McCormick was last seen by someone other than Durst the evening of January 31, 1982, when she appeared unexpectedly at a dinner party thrown by her friend Gilbert Najme in Newton, Connecticut. Najme noticed that McCormick was upset, was wearing red sweatpants, which Najme found odd. McCormick had often dressed in much higher quality clothing. McCormick later left for her material home in South Salem, New York, after a phone call from her husband. Though the couple argued and fought that evening, Durst maintained that he put his wife on a commuter train to New York City at Katona Station, had a drink with a neighbor, and spoke to his wife at their Manhattan apartment by telephone later that evening. That's what I told police, Durst later told documentary filmmakers. I was hoping that would just make everything go away. After McCormick had left Najmeh's house, she was supposed to meet Najmeh at a pub called the Lion's Gate in Manhattan. When she failed to show up, Najmeh became concerned and repeatedly called the police for several days. Days later, Durst filed a missing persons report as well. A doorman and the building superintendent at the couple's apartment in Riverside Drive claimed to have seen McCormick there on February 1st, which is one day after she was last indisputably seen. But the doorman also said that he had seen her only from behind and from half a block away and couldn't be certain it was her. A private investigator hired by Durst's own criminal lawyer later reported that the doorman said he had not seen McCormick arrive at all and may not have been working the night she disappeared. McCormick had been treated at a Bronx hospital for fractural bruises 3 weeks before her disappearance. She told a friend that Durst beat her but did not press charges over the incident. McCormick asked Durst for a $250,000 divorce settlement. Instead, Durst canceled his wife's credit card, removed her name from a joint bank account, and refused to pay her medical school tuition. At the time McCormick disappeared, Durst had been dating Prudence Farrow for 3 years and was living in a separate apartment. Durst initially offered $100,000 for his wife's return, then reduced the reward to $15,000. Only 3 weeks after Durst reported McCormick missing, the superintendent at the Riverside Drive apartment found her possessions in the building's trash compactor. When one of McCormick's friends and her sister found out that she had been reported missing, they broke into her cottage hoping to find her. Instead, they found the cottage ransacked, McCormick's mail left unopened, and her belongings in the trash. It's one of those bizarro murders here on the dark side of Wikipedia. If you like the show, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. And if you want to hear all of our episodes, all commercial free, get advanced episodes of the show and all the final chapters to our episodes, sign up to become a Darksider at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. It's Tony and Sean on today's episode. Sounds like a lovely relationship, and everything was going so smoothly up until her disappearance.
The red sweatpants, I think, are going to come to fruition as the answer to whodunit.
It's a bizarre thing for someone, you know, if you're kind of going to like your society type parties and things, to show up in red sweatpants, that would be a giant red flag. And it would make you wonder what the hell's going on. But if you're like severely depressed, if you're going through a lot of shit, like, all right, damn it, I'm just going to go to this thing.
A pandemic, maybe.
Yeah, a pandemic. And you're not caring and you're just like, whatever. That may be the sign that there's a bit of strife going on, because normally you would not be doing that. It's a very simple sign, but one that would certainly stand out.
Also, reward money. If your wife is missing, to go so big, $100,000, and so quickly then to reduce it to $15,000, why? I mean, short of, well, business is not as booming as we thought, so I can only give you X amount if you know where my, you know, wife is.
And I'll give you a commission on body parts. If you bring me a limb, you get $4,000. Yeah, I mean, it's...
So basically, if you put everything together and the whole body is found back, that 15 really turns into 84,000 with incentives.
That's before taxes. We'll take taxes out as well and make sure we get you a 1099 to submit to the IRS for bringing us those body parts. That'd be a weird letter to write. Obviously, the cause for suspicion and people investigating this over the years and trying to dig into it, even though he was found not guilty and or never prosecuted on some of these things, one has to wonder, what the fuck? You know, if it looks like a dog, it smells like a dog, it barks like a dog, probably a fucking dog. I don't know. I mean, it's... I'm interested to dig deeper into the other accusations, because it wasn't just her that one is surrounded by. And you have to take a look at this and go, the average individual, income not being a factor, because I don't think this is something that necessarily surrounds anyone to this level, no matter what socioeconomic state someone is in. How often are you connected to the possibility of being the suspect in a murder case? How often does it happen to one person in their lifetime? Probably most, none at all. To have been connected possibly as a suspect to three people, that's, I think you're really fucking beating the odds there to be that in that level of suspicion and be innocent.
You should definitely buy a lottery ticket, because if you can get that close and not be convicted, you're doing something right.
Yeah.
Or a lot of things wrong right. I don't know. And that, again, I defer to the legal experts of probable cause or evidence or whatever the verbiage is. Sadly, if you know, like, you did it, man. You did it not once, not twice, but thrice. But if we don't have enough evidence, and then you get factored into how this played out with juries, and I am the type of human, and the way that my mind works, if I'm an attorney or I'm a prosecutor, I would have a lot of sleepless nights not being able to have the ingredients to ultimately bake a conviction. Like, you fucking did it, man.
Yeah.
But I need to find and need to work with a team. And, you know, maybe you're dealing with a lazy police department who did a good job at the original scene. And why did you not take those fingerprints? Why? So many things that may or may not have played into why he has not been convicted.
Let's continue on with the story and get into the investigation and aftermath of the McCormick portion of his life. After McCormick went missing, police said that Durst had claimed to have last spoken to her when she called him at the Riverside Drive apartment. He claimed that the last time he had seen her was at Katona Station, where she was planning to board a 9:15 p.m. train to Manhattan. He also claimed that on February 4th, the supervisor at her medical school called him and said that she had called in sick on February 1st and was absent from class for the entire week. It's uncertain if it was indeed McCormick who made the call. The day after Durst received the call from McCormick's medical school, he reported her as missing. The police found his stories to be full of contradictions. 8 years after McCormick's disappearance, Durst divorced her, claiming spousal abandonment. In 2016, the McCormick family asked to have Kathleen declared dead, a request that was granted the following year. Kathleen's mother, Ann McCormick, attempted to sue Durst for $100 million, alleging that he killed McCormick and deprived him of the right to bury her. McCormick's parents are now deceased. Her younger sister, Mary McCormick Hughes, also believes that Durst murdered her. The New York State Police quietly reopened the criminal investigation into the disappearance in 1999, searching Durst's former South Salem residence for the first time. The investigation became public in November of 2000. In August of 2019, a wrongful death lawsuit filed by McCormick's sister, Carol Beaumont, against Durst, which accused him of murdering his wife, was dismissed on the grounds that she had waited too long to file the suit. The death date for McCormick has been changed to most likely at the time she disappeared in 1982. Due to murder, instead of the previous determination of 1987 for a missing person. Homicide of Susan Berman. Susan Berman, a longtime friend of Durst, who had facilitated his public alibi after McCormick's disappearance, was the daughter of David Berman, a reported gangster who, in the late 1940s, operated the Flamingo Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. On December 24th, 2000, Berman was found murdered execution style in her home in Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles, California, after her neighbors called the police to report that her back door was open and her three fox terriers were loose. A few days later, the Beverly Hills Police Department received a handwritten note postmarked December 23rd, which contained Berman's address and the word cadaver. Durst is known to have been in Northern California days before Berman was killed, and to have flown from San Francisco to New York the night before Berman's body was discovered. Berman had recently received $50,000 from Durst in two payments. Although Durst confirmed to Los Angeles Police Department that he had sent her $25,000 and faxed investigators a copy of her 1982 deposition regarding his missing wife, he declined to be further questioned about Berman's murder. Durst said in a 2005 deposition that Berman called him shortly before her death to say that the LAPD wanted to talk to her about McCormick's disappearance. A study of case notes by The Guardian cast doubt on whether the LAPD had made such a call or whether then Westchester County District Attorney Janine Pereiro had scheduled an interview with Berman at all. Durst moved to Galveston, Texas in 2000 and lived in a boarding house as he had gone into hiding and begun posing as a woman to avoid police inquiries. Durst had been tipped off to the reopening of the investigation into his wife's disappearance on October 31st, 2000, and immediately began planning for life as a fugitive. Berman's biographer Kathy Scott has asserted that Durst killed her because she knew too much about McCormick's disappearance. On October 9th, 2001, Durst was arrested in Galveston shortly after body parts belonging to his elderly neighbor Morris Black were found floating in Galveston Bay. He was released on $300,000 bail the next day. Durst missed a court hearing on October 16th, and a warrant was issued for his arrest, a charge of bail jumping. On November 30th, he was caught inside a Wegman supermarket in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, after trying to shoplift Band-Aids, a newspaper, and a chicken salad sandwich, even though he had $500 cash in his pocket. A police search of his rental car yielded $37,000 in cash, two guns, marijuana, Black's driver's license, and directions to Gilbert Najimé's home in Connecticut. Durst also used his time on the run to stalk his brother Douglas, visiting the driveway of his home in Katona, New York, while armed. Durst employed defense attorney John Waldron while he was held on charges in Pennsylvania. He was eventually extradited to Texas for trial. That better been one hell of a chicken salad sandwich. You got $500 in cash. You got $37,000 in the car, two guns, and you're stealing a chicken salad sandwich from the Wegmans. Something doesn't quite add up here in terms of this person being mentally healthy.
Yeah, I think that right there is definitive evidence of, okay, you've done this to elude this. You've done this. You've done this. You're posing as a female. You're doing all these things that are kind of smart to not get caught. But then you do, like, really? $6.19, just fucking give him a 20 and pay for it and
walk out.
You're low profile, my friend.
Band-Aids and a chicken salad sandwich.
I just,
I don't know what to make of that. But I mean, that's how it often works. You have these individuals that are, you know, they can be extremely intelligent and they can elude police. They can elude family members. They can get away with shit left and right because they know how to do it at such a deep level. But then when it comes to something as simple as pay for your fucking Band-Aids and chicken salad sandwich so you don't blow everything up, that's the part that they overlook and think, I'm good enough at all these things. The least I can do is steal a chicken salad sandwich. Nope, it turns out you can't. But you can get away with murder for almost 20 years. But chicken salad sandwich theft? Not in your fucking wheelhouse.
Look at this. I'm going to steal this $6 sandwich with $500 in my pocket. Yeah. I'm good. I'm real good. Nope, you are a dumbass.
That's the scary thing, and that's often how people like this get caught. Let's go into the trial portion and learn about the judgments that were made. I'm guessing that were far more than just over the chicken salad. In 2003, Durst was tried for the murder of Black. He employed defense attorney Dick DeGroen and claimed self-defense. DeGroen conducted two mock trials in preparation for the case. Durst's defense team had difficulty communicating with him, so they hired psychiatrist Dr. Milton Altshuler to find out why. Altshuler spent over 70 hours examining Durst and diagnosed him with Asperger's syndrome, saying his whole life's history is so compatible with the diagnosis. His defense team argued that the trial in this diagnosis explained his behavior. Durst claimed he and Black, a cranky and confrontational loner, struggled for control of Durst's 22 caliber target pistol after Black grabbed it from its hiding place and threatened him with it. During the struggle, the pistol discharged, shooting Black in the face. During cross-examination, Durst admitted to using a paring knife, two saws, and an axe to dismember Black's body before bagging and dumping his remains in Galveston Bay. Black's head was never recovered, so prosecutors were unable to present sufficient forensic evidence to dispute Durst's account of the struggle. As a result of lack of forensics, the jury acquitted Durst of murder on the 11th of November, 2003. On December 21st, 2004, Durst pled guilty to two counts of bail jumping and one count of evidence tampering for his dismemberment of Black's body. As part of a plea bargain, he received a sentence of 5 years and was given credit for time served, requiring him to serve 3 years in prison. Durst was paroled on the 15th of July, 2005. The rules of his release required him to stay near his home. Permission was required to travel. That December, Durst made an unauthorized trip to a boarding house where Black had been killed and a nearby shopping mall. At the mall, he ran into former Galveston trial judge Susan Criss, who had presided over his trial. Due to this incident, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles determined that Durst had violated the terms of his parole and returned him to jail. He was released again from custody on March 1, 2006. Asked in March 2015 whether she believed Durst murdered Black, Criss commented, "You could see that this person knew what they were doing and that it was not a first time. The body was cut perfectly like a surgeon who knew how to use his tool on this bone and certain kind of tool on that muscle. It looked like not a first-time job. It was pretty scary." The Jinx TV documentary in early 2015, a six-part HBO documentary titled The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, describes circumstantial evidence linking Durst to the murder of Berman, who was believed to have knowledge of McCormick's disappearance. The documentary detailed the disappearance of McCormick Berman's subsequent death and the killing of Black. Against the advice of his lawyers and his wife Deborah Lee Chardon, Durst gave multiple interviews and unrestricted access to his personal records to filmmakers. The FBI arrested Durst in New Orleans the same day as the final episode was broadcast. The documentary ended with him moving into a bathroom where his microphone recorded him seemingly saying to himself, "There it is, you're caught. You're right, of course, but you can't imagine. Arrest him. I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this. What a disaster. He was right. I was wrong. All the burping. I have difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." The Associated Press reported that a March 1999 letter from Durst to Berman, discovered by a stepson and turned over to the filmmakers during the research, provided key new evidence leading to the filing of murder charges. A few days after, a first-degree murder warrant was signed by a Los Angeles judge in relation to Berman's killing. Durst was arrested by FBI agents on March 14, 2015, at the Canal Street Marriott in New Orleans, where he had registered under the false name Everett Ward. Durst, who had been tracked to the hotel after making two calls to check his voicemail, was observed wandering aimlessly in the lobby and mumbling to himself, having driven to New Orleans from Houston 4 days before. In addition to a .38 revolver loaded with four live rounds and one spent shell casing, police recovered 5 ounces of marijuana, Durst's birth certificate and passport, maps of Louisiana, Florida, and Cuba, a flesh-toned latex mask, the fake Texas ID used to check into the hotel, a new cell phone, and cash totaling $42,631. Police discovered a UPS tracking number, which led to an additional $117,000 cash and a pair of shoes in a package sent to Durst by a friend in New York, which was seized after his arrest. Bank statements found in one of Durst Houston's condominiums revealed cash withdrawals of $315,000 in little more than a month. On March 15, 2015, New York State Police investigator Joseph Becerra, long involved in the McCormick case and said to have been working closely with the FBI and Los Angeles detectives, removed some 60 file boxes of Durst's personal papers and effects from the home of Durst's friend Susan T. Girondo in Campbell Hall, New York. All of these items had been sent to Girondo for safekeeping 3 years prior by Deborah Lee Chardon, Durst's wife at the time. Also stored at Girondo's residence were videotaped depositions of Durst, Durst's brother, Douglas, and Chardon, all of which were related to the Black case. Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney John Lewin, in charge of prosecuting Durst, claimed to have found information uncovered by the filmmakers in the HBO documentary series, The Jinx, to be compelling and repeatedly flew to New York to interview witnesses, including friends of Durst and Berman. On March 16, 2015, defense attorney Richard DeGrone advised court authorities in New Orleans that his client waived extradition and would voluntarily return to California. Late that same day, Louisiana State Police filed charges against Durst for being a felon in possession of a firearm and for possession of a firearm with a controlled substance. Forestalling his immediate return to California, Orleans Parish District Attorney Leon Canizero commented that in light of prior convictions that could influence Durst's sentencing, just for those gun charges here in Louisiana, Durst could face up to life in prison. On March 23rd, Durst was denied bail by a Louisiana judge after prosecutors argued he was a flight risk. In an effort to hasten his extradition to California and avoid a protracted Louisiana court battle, Agron raised questions about the validity of the New Orleans arrest and hotel room search, pointing out that a local judge did not issue a warrant until hours after his client was detained. While communicating with the LAPD and conducting an inventory of Durst's hotel room possessions, the FBI held him there, incommunicado, for almost 8 hours. According to DeGurn, Durst was questioned extensively by a Los Angeles prosecutor and detective without a lawyer present on the morning after his arrest. In failing to produce the arresting officer's subpoena for a probable cause hearing, Durst's attorneys charged that Louisiana prosecutors engaged in a misguided attempt to conceal the facts from the court, the defendant, and the public. Peter Mansfield, an assistant U.S. attorney, said that his office instructed the two FBI agents and arresting officer not to appear, arguing that DeGurn's subpoenas were issued in an attempt to conduct actions against them in their official capacities for the purposes of obtaining testimony, information, and material maintained under color of their official duties. On April 8th, a day after a U.S. attorney filed an independent federal weapons charge, Durst was formally indicted by Louisiana grand jury for carrying a weapon with a controlled substance and for the illegal possession of a firearm by a felon. Later that month, Durst's lawyers requested that more than $161,000 seized by authorities during their searches be returned, saying the cash is not needed as evidence, is not contraband, and is not subject to forfeiture. After negotiations with Durst's defense team, Louisiana authorities ultimately dropped weapons charges against Durst on April 23, 2015. Durst's trial on the federal weapons charge was scheduled for September 21, 2015. DeGurn confirmed rumors that Durst was in poor health, saying he suffers from hypercephalitis and had a stent put into his skull 2 years before, as well as spinal surgery and a cancerous mass removed from his esophagus. Durst's attorneys requested a later date for the federal weapons charge trial, saying they need more time to prepare after rulings on pending motions. U.S. District Judge Helen Berrigan later rescheduled the trial to January 11, 2016. On November 16, 2015, a New Orleans federal judge ordered Durst re-arraigned on the weapons charges and scheduled a hearing for December 17th. When asked, Durst's attorneys said only that Durst did not kill Berman, that he wants to resolve the other charges to expedite Durst's extradition to Los Angeles to face that charge. On December 16, 2015, prosecutors and defense attorneys told Berrigan in a joint motion that scheduling conflicts ruled out all dates before a January 11th trial date. Berrigan ultimately rescheduled the trial for February 3, 2016, and Durst changed his plea to guilty to the federal gun charge and received an 85-month prison sentence. Durst was originally placed in USP Terre Haute, but was later transferred to Los Angeles County Jail, awaiting trial. The trial was scheduled to begin in Los Angeles after Durst was arraigned in California, but his transfer was delayed by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons due to serious surgery, according to DeGrone. A conditional hearing was convened in February 2017, where Nick Chauvin, Durst's close friend and best man at Chauvin's wedding, testified that Durst had confessed to him of having murdered Berman. Chauvin will be one of the prosecution's witnesses against Durst. A preliminary hearing was initially scheduled for October 2017, but was postponed to April 2018 to accommodate Durst's defense team, some of whom suffered damage to their homes and offices from Hurricane Harvey. The pretrial hearings included extensive testimony from a number of older witnesses who potentially would not be available when the trial itself begins. In October 2018, Los Angeles County Superior Judge Mark Windham ruled that there was enough evidence to try Durst for the murder of Berman, and Durst would be arraigned on November 8, 2018. During his court appearance the following day, Durst pled not guilty. In January 2019, Windham set Durst's trial date as September 3, 2019. At the same time, the judge ruled that prosecutors can present evidence involving the Black murder. Prosecutors will try to connect Berman's death with McCormick's disappearance, which they want to show as a foundation for the motive for Berman's slaying. In his ruling that prosecutors could use evidence from the Texas case, Judge Windham said the killings of Black and Berman seem to be intertwined. The murder charge against Durst includes a special circumstance allegation of lying in wait and killing witnesses to a crime. Is also an allegation that he used a handgun to carry out the murder. In May 2019, a motion filed by Durst's attorneys claimed two handwriting samples The anonymous cadaver note from 2000 informing Beverly Hills police that a body could be found at her house, and a letter in 1999 from Durst to Berman, along with other evidence from his 2015 arrest at his hotel in New Orleans, were illegally obtained. Durst's lawyers also claimed there was a Fourth Amendment violation that would exclude the New Orleans evidence and that the search of his hotel room was unlawful. On May 8, 2019, Los Angeles County prosecutors filed an affidavit replying to the motion. Prosecutor John Lewin, and Durst is creating an elaborate conspiracy theory between the producers of the HBO documentary miniseries The Jinx, law enforcement officers, and the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office to make the defendant incriminate himself and to time his arrest to maximize media attention and ratings. However, defendant completely fails to acknowledge the most relevant fact leading to his arrest and the subsequent search of his hotel room. In damning interview, law enforcement was on notice that the defendant was actively preparing to flee the county right after crucial evidence connecting him to Susan Berman's murder was widely publicized on national television. When viewed in this context, it is readily apparent that the actions taken by law enforcement were more than reasonable. They were absolutely necessary to prevent a murderer who had already avoided apprehension for more than 30 years from fleeing the country and evading justice. On May 17, 2019, L.A. County Judge Mark Windham granted Durst's defense team a four-month postponement of his murder trial. The delay was granted after defense lawyers raised concerns about the volume of evidence in the case and conflicts with attorney schedules. On September 3, 2019, L.A. County Judge Mark Windham rejected an attempt by defense attorneys for Durst to strip the producers of The Jinx of protection under California's Journalist Shield Law by having them declared government agents. A number of other procedural rulings also went against Durst. L.A. County Prosecuting Attorney John Lewin set another hearing on discovery and other matters on October 28th. Additional evidential hearings were held in December 2019 regarding the admissibility of statements Durst made in March 2015 just after his arrest in New Orleans in an interview with Lewin. In a surprise move on December 24th, 2019, Durst's lawyers contradicted his previous statements and filed court documents admitting that Durst wrote the cadaver note. In all previous statements about the note, Durst consistently denied writing the note, although the handwriting appears to be similar to his own, as is the misspelling of the word Beverly, contained in a prior letter to Berman that Durst admitted to authoring. During the filming of The Jinx, Durst told the filmmakers that the person who wrote the cadaver note was taking a big risk because it was something that only the killer could have written. He told his godson, Howard Altman, the person who wrote the note killed her. However, in August 2019, Durst's attorney also argued that what the note demonstrates is that the person who mailed it was aware that there was a body at the house, not that the individual murdered Susan Berman. On the 2nd of March 2020, Durst appeared in court to begin his trial for the murder of Susan Berman, which was expected to take several months. However, the proceedings were postponed amid the COVID-19 pandemic. In June 2020, a motion by the defense for a mistrial because of the delay was denied. In July 2020, L.A. County Judge Mark Windham ruled that the further delay until April 2021 was necessary due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but he would allow the trial to proceed if Durst agreed to a bench trial without jury. Durst declined this option, and the trial is scheduled to resume on April 12th, 2021. All because of a chicken salad sandwich and misspelling the word Beverly. Two things every serial killer should know.
Just a reminder, all of you little ones, if you're serial killers that don't want to get caught, the great saying, spell check yourself before you wreck yourself, holds true.
So, spell check yourself before you wreck yourself.
That was actually told to me early in, I was an intern in a radio station, and one of the on-air radio disc jockeys just randomly said it because it was something with the contest and something was misspelled and something on the website, and it stuck with me.
I like it. I've never heard that.
In any event, listen to your English teachers. Learn how to write. Learn how to spell. So that you can successfully commit crimes later in life and not get caught.
I think it's the one on the poster would be like, so you can live a successful crime-free life or something of that nature. Not so you can successfully commit crimes and not get caught. But it probably is applicable either way. It all depends just how crazy you are.
At the rate we're at, man, of things that were so unthinkable, let alone undoable, I mean, that threshold is continuing on. And at the end of the day, it's all about the almighty dollar. So yeah. Some people are insurance agents. Some people kill for money. Just make sure you spell ransom notes with correct spelling of names. Beverly.
Yeah.
Like Beverly Hills. Fuck, he lived in the same city.
It's the little things that matter.
It really is.
Days after the Berman murder, police were reportedly examining connections between Durst and the disappearances of 18-year-old Lynn Schulze from Middlebury, Vermont, and 16-year-old Karen Mitchell from Eureka, California. Investigators are also looking into a possible connection between Durst and the disappearance of 18-year-old Christian Madafari, who was last seen in San Francisco in 1997. Schulze, a Middlebury College freshman, visited Durst's health food store on December 10, 1971, the day she disappeared, and was last seen that afternoon near a bus stop across from the store. DeGuerin characterized the Schulze investigation as opportunistic and said he would not permit his clients to be questioned by Vermont police. Author investigative journalist Matt Birkbeck reported in 2003 and again in his 2015 book, A Deadly Secret, that credit card records placed Durst in Eureka on November 25, 1997, the day Mitchell vanished. Mitchell may have volunteered in a homeless shelter that Durst frequents. Durst, dressed in women's clothing, had visited the Eureka shoe store owned by Mitchell's aunt. Mitchell was last seen walking to work from her aunt's store and possibly speaking to someone in a stopped car. A witness sketch of Mitchell's presumed abductor resembles Durst. Although the FBI ultimately could not connect Durst to the Long Island serial murders, in which some victims were disposed of in a similar matter to the Black killing, the Bureau created an informal task force in 2012 to work with investigative agencies in jurisdictions where Durst was known to have lived in past decades, including Vermont, New York, and California. In the wake of his recent arrest, the FBI encouraged such localities to re-examine cold cases. Texas private investigator Bobby Baca has also traced Durst operating under stolen identities in Texas, Florida, Massachusetts, New Jersey, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Virginia. On December 11, 2000, shortly before the Berman killing, Durst married Deborah Lee Charton. According to the New York Times, the couple briefly shared a Fifth Avenue apartment in 1990, but had never lived together as husband and wife. Durst once told his sister, "It was a marriage of convenience. I wanted Debbie to be able to receive my inheritance, and I intended to kill myself," Durst said in a 2005 deposition. According to the New York Times, Charton lived with one of Durst's real estate lawyers, Stephen I. Holm, as of May 2017. It was reported in Real Estate Weekly that Stephen Holm died October 17, 2019, and Deborah Lee Charton was his wife. After being referred to as Holm's wife at his funeral and in the obituary in the New York Times, Charton sent the Times a letter saying she and Holm were not married and asked him to print a retraction. Charton and Holm were involved with a number of philanthropical. Philanthropy is the word we're talking about. Philanthropic. There we go. Philanthropic ventures together. I think we got it there. Durst traveled and lived under dozens of aliases over the years, using different identities to buy cars, rent apartments, and open credit card accounts. He had a scanner copier and a laminating machine. A former office employee of Durst told Newsweek, "What I didn't realize is that unwittingly I saw what would have allowed Robert Durst to make a fake driver's license." Durst was also a prolific user of private mailboxes and apparently conducted business under a number of canine-themed names. Woofing LLC, Woof Woof LLC, Igor Fayette, Inc. In the early 1980s, Durst owned a series of seven Alaskan Malamutes, all of which were named Igor, and all of which died under mysterious circumstances, according to his brother Douglas. In December 2014, prior to the airing of The Jinx, Douglas told the New York Times that, in retrospect, "I now believe he was practicing killing and disposing of his wife with those dogs." Durst was once recorded saying he wanted to Igor Douglas. Durst, however, has disputed the assertion that he owned seven dogs named Igor. He owned three, he said, one that was run over and another that died in surgery after eating an apple core, before the Igor that lasted forever. In late 1981, while Durst was still married to McCormick, he was nearing the end of a three-year affair with Prudence Farrow, who was also married at the time. According to the New York Post, a few months before McCormick's disappearance in January 1982, Farrow called her and asked that she give Durst up. His friend said she wanted him all to herself. After Durst was acquitted of murdering Black in 2003, Farrow contacted law enforcement authorities with concerns for her safety. As she said, Durst was angry with her for terminating their relationship 3 days before McCormick disappeared. Durst has had a number of significant medical issues since 2015, including major surgeries for esophageal cancer, having a shunt installed in his brain for and cervical spinal fusion. When arrested in New Orleans in 2015, he was found to be in possession of a variety of drugs, including the sleep aid melatonin, a muscle relaxant, and medications for high blood pressure, blood flow, and acid reflux. In mid-2002, Durst signed an over power of attorney to Chariton and is believed their holdings remain closely intermingled. Although the current status of their relationship is unknown, in 2006, Durst gave Chariton around $20 million of his $65 million trust settlement. In 2011, Durst purchased a $1.75 million townhouse in Lenox Avenue in Harlem. A source close to his estranged family confirmed that he was living there at least some of the time, and they were keeping him under surveillance. Durst also owns three condominiums and a multi-story complex in Houston. And after filing suit, received $200,000 in settlement in 2006 from a Houston developer who refused to let him move into a unit newly purchased by his wife, which he had then immediately resold to Durst for $10. At the time of Berman's murder in Los Angeles, Durst had just sold the home in Trinidad, California, but maintained an office in Eureka while renting in nearby Big Lagoon. Media have vigorously reported Durst's financial status as real estate baron, rich scion, millionaire, multimillionaire, and billionaire. The Durst family's real estate holdings are worth more than $4 billion, but his brother Douglas was in control of the company beginning in 1994, shortly before their father's death. From about 1994 to 2006, Robert waged a legal campaign to gain greater control of the family trust and fortune. During that time, he received $2 million a year from the trust. In 2006, the case was settled, with Durst giving up any interest in his family's properties and trust in exchange for a one-time payment of about $65 million. It's unknown how much of that went to legal fees and taxes. Durst remained active in real estate, but reportedly sold two properties in 2014 for $21.15 million, after purchasing them in 2011 for $8.65 million. At the time of his 2015 arrest, the FBI estimated Durst's net worth to be approximately $100 million. The New York Times estimated his net worth at $110 million. On May 1, 2015, the New York Post reported that Douglas had settled litigation against Jinx filmmaker Andrew Jarkey, having confirmed that Robert was the source of videotaped depositions that appeared in the documentary. Robert's disclosure apparently violated the terms of his 2006 agreement with the Durst family, which had dispersed him a lump sum of family trust assets, although it was unclear whether Jarkey confirmed Robert as his source. New York Times reported in March 2015 that Jarkey was given unrestricted access to Robert's personal records, including the videotape material. The settlement paves the way for Douglas to reclaim as much as $74 million of his brother's assets, effectively freezing those assets pending court judgment. This could affect Robert's ability to pay for high-caliber legal representation without tapping into real estate or other investments. The Post reported that Douglas was mulling his next move. In November 2015, nearly 34 years after her disappearance, McCormick's three sisters and 101-year-old mother sued Durst for $100 million, citing his apparent role in her murder and his denial to her family of the right to sepulcher, a New York law that grants immediate relatives access to a deceased person's body and the opportunity to determine appropriate burial. If successful, the law could deprive Durst of most or all of his inherited fortune. McCormick's brother James had attempted in October 2015 to file a wrongful death suit against Durst on behalf of his mother, but was challenged by one of his sisters, who holds her mother's power of attorney. McGurn said that there is no evidence that Robert Durst had anything to do with Kathleen's disappearance. Anybody can file a lawsuit, but eventually they'll have to come with evidence. On December 7, 2015, the same family members filed suit asking the court to freeze Durst assets The family's attorney, Robert Abrams, called Durst the poster child for why courts block defendants from disposing assets while civil lawsuits are pending. In July 2016, the McCormick family asked the surrogate's court in Manhattan to declare that Kathy died on January 31st, 1982, when she was murdered by her husband, Robert Durst, so the self-served lawsuit could proceed. The court granted the request in 2017. So there's a lot of stuff in this guy's past that could likely still come to light as him being responsible for. I mean, hence him cutting up the guy and everybody looking at the parts going, this was done by a real work of art. This was a master of cutting up people. You know, just like they look at the Lindt chocolate makers on the commercial. But this guy, they're looking at him, you know, with that same, you know, vigor and valor of, wow, he's really good with the knife. Sounds like he'd been up to it for a while. And I would guess even more than what we're even aware of based on his story thus far.
These three that we are aware of could be three of six, nine, 12. I mean, when you're talking about a sick and twisted individual and then you toss in a strong, hefty financial background, like I can pay for anything I want. So whether I've done something or I've paid other people to do something. Oh, and then by the way, I can afford the best legal representation to work myself out of being free for the rest of my life until I die. Yeah. What are you going to do? Can't touch me.
Yeah.
So basically, kids, as we talked about earlier, not only learn how to spell correctly, but get a good job so you can make a shit ton of money. And then when you want to kill people, you can afford to, you know, keep yourself free.
Unless you just inherit it.
You lucky son of a bitch. If you inherit a crap ton of money from your family's fortune and you choose to then start breaking the law, even the smallest law, well, you're just stupid. Like, you're dumb. You're set. You have money. Find a hobby that doesn't involve killing seven dogs named Igor? Come on!
That's not a red flag or anything.
Here's the deal. All along the way, when we talk about these people who have, you know, killed humans, that's terrible. In all seriousness, absolutely tragic. Can't think of a word that represents how absolutely horrifying it is.
Sure.
With that being said, I have a certain disdain and an even higher sense of you putrid human specimen. If you not only do this to humans, but you do it to animals. That's it, in my opinion, as an animal lover, that is next level fuckery.
It is. And I think my dog actually had heard me talking about the destruction of the dogs because he got up off the ground where he's laying by my feet. And now he's like, he's sitting right next. He's got his head right next to my armrest. And he's just kind of like staring at me like, please tell me you're not talking about plans for the afternoon. No, Sting, I'm not. This was a Wikipedia story of a very crazy person. You're all good. You're safe. We're not going to practice cutting you up to learn how to kill people. It's fucked up. But there you go. Can you imagine putting that one on a dating profile? I have seven dogs named Igor.
And the thing of it is, this fuck job has been married.
That's true. My question is, how the fuck do you stay with somebody like that? I mean,
money.
Yeah,
money.
There's your answer.
Money.
You got 65 million. I guess you can deal with the seven Igor dogs and all of the suspicions that your husband has been up to killing people and him going out in public dressed as a woman. Not because he wants to, because of, you know, gender preferences or anything like that, but because he's hiding. Because he's hiding from people. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's a I don't want to be killed or arrested choice. I would think, I don't know. Where do you draw the line where like money is, it's just not worth the 65 mil.
Which is what I was going to ask of, again, many of these murderers are males, but if there's a female of this magnitude, would you marry, if this was Roberta Durst, not Robert, would you marry this woman who is worth $100 million? Like, I don't care what you've done. I don't care how many people you've killed. hopefully it's not me. I'm going to actually live on the other side of the country in my own estate that you specifically have paid for, and I'm living off your family's millions. Would you do it?
No. And then all in the end, it's all going to end up probably getting taken back in through all the lawsuits. And, you know, it'll either be auctioned off or it will be just, you know, taken back in by the brother or, you know, there's so many people that are going after him for whatever he has. He's going to have nothing when all this is said and done. He'll probably, my guess is he's going to get off easy because he'll probably die is what my guess will be. He'll kick it before they can get the full-blown conviction. And then, of course, all the stuff will be settled in some other way, shape, or form. But that's how it seems to work for a lot of folks like this, is they do all their horrible shit. They live their life is whatever they want to do and then die.
And then there's 9-year-olds that pass away when they're 9 that are just starting life.
Yeah.
It's amazing how fucked up the world is.
It is. It is. And as always, this show has been a breath of fresh air to make you start your day in a good place, right?
Sunshine, ponies and rainbows.
I guess you can say, well, at least that's not my world. At least I hope most of our listeners can say that.
This has been a True Crime Today Dark Side Flashback. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our new episodes every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. Breaking news stories and daily briefs from True Crime Today.